This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
Our voice, preserving our stories. Join Caroline Vogels and Jess Moore for an insight into the lives of our community elders. Joy 94.9 gratefully acknowledges the support of the Victorian Government and Public Record Office Victoria for making this project possible.
Gordon Wilson, a significant contributor to the GLBTI community, being involved with organisations such as Victorian AIDS Council, the AIDS Memorial Quilt Project, board member of Vintage Men, and the oldest volunteer at Joy, joining Jess and I on Our Voice. Welcome, Gordon. Gordon Wilson, a significant contributor to the GLBTI community, being involved with organisations such as Victorian AIDS Council, the AIDS Memorial Quilt Project, board member of Vintage Men, and the oldest volunteer at Joy, joining Jess and I on Our Voice. Welcome, Gordon.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you grew up in Perth as a young lad in the 40s. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, born in Port Hedland, and I have the distinction of being the last baby born in the Bush Nursing Hospital before they closed it and opened the new hospital, which has just been closed again and a new one built because of all the stuff they're doing up there with the mining.
Were you the eldest or the youngest?
I was the middle. Oh, okay. I have an elder brother and a younger sister, and there was one born between me and my sister, but he only lived a couple of hours and died.
Oh,
yeah, so, we came down from Port Hedland when I was about three and lived in a place called Leaderville.
And did the death of the other child have any impact with your family?
Well, it would have perhaps on Mum and Dad, but we never knew about it. Because we were too young.
Right.
We just didn't know. We didn't even realise Mum had gone into hospital to have another baby. You know, that's that because you're so young, you know.
Did she ever talk about it later?
Never. Mm. Never talked about it. Much later, she used to say, oh, it would have been your brother's birthday on the day when he was born. But that's the end. And they did call him Edward. He had a name. He was called Edward after my uncle, my mother's brother.
Oh, okay, that must have been very difficult.
Mm. Well, it is difficult when a woman loses a child. Mm. You know, it only lives a few hours, or it's stillborn, or the one where they die in their sleep. It's awful. Mm. It must be a terrible tragedy for a woman, you know, and a husband too. Yeah, the whole family actually.
Mm. So was that just really something that wasn't discussed?
Well, in those days, you didn't discuss things.
Right.
It was if you're a child, you were seen and not heard. Which is the way it was, but not like it is today, where everybody has an opinion on everything, you know, even from the youngest about what they're going to do and what they want to do and all the rest of it. We were never allowed to do that.
Mm.
It was did as you were told.
Got basically. On with it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So how do you find your way to express yourself as a child in that sort of environment?
Well, it's what you grew up with. You didn't know anything else.
Right.
You see, this is the way that everything has changed. Every generation has changed since, and that's three generations ago, with me.
Yeah.
So a generation is every 25 years, basically, and that was all we knew. We didn't know anything else.
So now you're on radio to express yourself.
Now you're on radio and can't stop talking.
Now, I've heard a bit of a rumour that you spent some time in a ballet studio.
I did. That's when I came out, actually. It was 1950. I was 14.
Oh, wow.
And I always wanted to be a ballet dancer. Always loved dancing, loved movement, loved that sort of stuff. So grew up loving Gene Kelly musicals and all that sort of thing. So I wanted to be a dancer, and that was one of the things that I wanted to be. So there was a dancing school in a place called Maddington down the road from Armidale, where I was living. And I said to my father, my mother first, I said, Mum, I want to go and learn to do ballet and be a ballet dancer, be a dancer. And Mother said, as they used to do when they say, well, you better go and ask your father. You know, you had to ask Dad for everything. He was the head of the family. So I went and spoke to Dad, and I said, Dad, I want to be a ballet dancer, and I want to go and take classes. And Dad said to me, he said, well, everybody will call you a sissy. And I said, but I am. So what?
So oh, how did you know that already? Oh, well,
I
was 14? Already.
I knew when I was about 8 or 9 that I was different.
And how did you know that?
It was just, I just knew that I was different, and I had already, by the time I was 14, I had already had a relationship with another boy from school.
Mm.
So I knew that I didn't care.
Yeah.
I didn't care that I was a sissy, and they used to make fun of me at school.
Yeah, did they bully you? Or
oh, they tried to, but I fought back.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to let them bully me, and one of them attacked me, and so I attacked him straight back, and I said, don't you dare, you know. And they just sort of thought, okay, it's no use doing that. So they just left me alone.
Where do you think you found that strength to be yourself?
I don't know. It was just one of those things. I thought, no, you can't hit me. I'm going to hit you back. And I did. And that was it.
And your siblings, how did they relate to you?
Well, I don't think they ever sort of realised. Right. It was only Mum and Dad that did.
Yep.
And I think Dad was a very... accepting person, because he'd already spent 3.5 years in Changi jail,
right,
during the war, where if you're in jail, relationships form.
Yep.
And I think he understood that this is possible.
Right.
You know.
Did you speak to him about that?
No, I never ever did. From that day, they always just knew, but it was never sort of mentioned again, and I just went on with my life.
And did you speak to your father about his time in Changi?
No. Well, he didn't talk about it very much. One story was that he was in the death tent, he was dying, and a doctor came in and said, look, get out of here, you're not going to die, you've got a family with 3 children to go home to, you've got to get out there and get move on. And now that doctor delivered his first grandchild.
Oh, wow, what an
That's
amazing
incredible.
Story.
Yeah, so just quite funny.
So, I'm quite fascinated with this first relationship you had as a young child.
He was right. He was pretty good. Yeah, 14. We used to get up the recreation ground at the back and, you know, play with one another. And, yeah, it was fun.
So when you say it was a relationship, why was it different to the friendships we'd all form as kids?
I don't know. We just liked one another. You know, we would see one another and we'd touch one another. And you'd even in the street, you'd sort of put your hand on his shoulder and that sort of thing. It was just, he did the same to me, you know, so it was just, I guess you'd call it a relationship,
yep.
You know, it was a bit more than just being in, hi, how are you, you know, it was a lot more than that.
And yeah. Was his parents aware of...
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. But see, they all felt that he was, they used to call him Boof because he was a bigger lad.
Oh, yeah.
But
good
he wasn't.
Around.
He wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, he was just, he was a... Nice man, nice young boy, nice young lad, you know.
And how
about
long?
About 14.
How long did it? The
that lasted for about 3 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Quite significant at that age.
Very significant.
Yeah. But it was just, it was just good. Yeah. So, but I still think of him, you know, and wonder what ever happened to him, because he'd be the same age now if he was still alive.
Yeah. And Gordon, recently you played a song on your own show called Nature Boy, which came from a movie about the boy with green hair.
It's called A Boy with Green Hair.
And that was around the time that you were...
Oh, yeah, that was in 1948 that was made, and we didn't see it in Armidale, where I lived, in the town hall, until probably about 1952, 53. And it was about a boy that had green hair and couldn't work out why he had green hair. But then the story was that he was a... war orphan, and that he was different. But years later, I read a story from somebody that was connected for the film that they said, no, it was actually a thing about people that were different rather than being war orphans. They were different to what everybody else was, and that was why he had the green hair. So it's a very interesting thing. But that's the Nature Boy was Nat King Cole's very first number one hit.
Mm. That's fantastic. So do you think after watching that, and finding out those reference of sort of being more of maybe a civil rights sort of movie, did that give you the confidence to embrace?
Well, I didn't need that much more confidence.
Yeah.
I knew what it was, and that was it, you know, and I've always been the same. I've never been anything else. And I always had my own personal motto was, if they're picking on me, they're not picking on somebody else that can't stand it.
That's great.
Let them pick on me, and I couldn't care less.
So that might be a nice lead-in to tell us about the song you brought along for us today.
I saw South Pacific in the movie. The first movie I saw was in the movies down here, just across the road from Joy, actually. There used to be a cinema across there, and that was back in about 1950. 58, 59.
So that would be in Bourke Street?
In Bourke Street.
Yep.
Yep, yep. And it was a song called You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. Now, this is probably one of the best songs that's ever been written. It's very short. It just says that you have to be taught to be afraid, to have all your prejudices and everything, because no child is born with prejudice and no child is born homophobic, and they all have to be taught to be this way. Everybody has to be taught to have these prejudices and homophobics.
Our community, our stories, our voice. Joy 94.9.
So you've crossed the Nullarbor, you've watched that movie in Melbourne.
Yes, I came here on the long weekend of the Australia Day weekend, January 1958, I think it was. I was 22.
Wow. And
yeah. Come to the big smoke.
Yeah, why did you do that first?
Well, I knew I was gay.
Yeah.
And the only way I could sort of basically leave home, because by 22 I should have probably been left home, but living in the country in... Well, it was country. It was only 18 miles out. Armidale's only 18 miles in the old measurement out of Perth. And I used to work at a big hotel in the city, and it was travel all the time. And I knew that I was gay, and you want to spread your wings. Like Perth in like the 50s wouldn't have been as big as Geelong is now. It was a very small city. There was a couple of gay people that used to go down Hay Street, and one of them was gorgeous. I used to talk to him. And he was one of those people that didn't care either.
Right.
You accepted me for who I am, or that's your problem. And so I thought, well, I want to come to Melbourne. And I did come to the year before. I'd gone round and I'd met my uncle, my mother's brother, in Sydney. And then I'd gone on to Cairns to meet my other uncle up there. And then I'd gone home to Perth, and I thought, no, I love Melbourne. I came over on a steamship when I first came over, I beg your pardon, on the holiday, the TSMV Manura. And I walked up Flinders Street from where they used to berth the boats down at the end of Flinders Street. And I walked right up Flinders Street, up Spring Street, down Little Collins Street, or one of those streets, and I just fell in love with Melbourne on that walk, and I was determined to come back here.
What did it look like in those days?
Oh, it was very well. It didn't have all these modern buildings. It was a low rise city, basically, because it wasn't until they built the ICI Tower up there that they had a bit of a tower in Melbourne, and it was just lovely. It was just some of the great old buildings and some of the old pubs. And I had my first drink in Melbourne in the Duke of Wellington, might have been the Duke of Wellington's, on the corner of Queen, I think it was, and Flinders Street, and it was a beaut pub.
So you came here not knowing anyone?
Didn't know a soul.
So you're a single, homosexual, 22-year-old man in a new city.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do?
Well, I did know someone. I had worked at the hotel in Perth, at the Savoy Hotel in Perth, and I'd worked with a woman in... She was a receptionist, and I was in the bar manager and all that sort of thing, stuff, and her brother was living here, and so I knew where he was. We lived in St Kilda Road, in a boarding house in St Kilda Road, right opposite the Shrine, which is no longer there. And we roomed together in this boarding house. There was a room with two beds and a little tiny oven, and you shared a bathroom down the hallway. And it finished up that John and I became partners for 17 and a half years.
Oh, wow.
So there you go.
Yeah, that was...
Just meant to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Was the Melbourne CBD a social area? Did people come into the city
Well, they did. We didn't know much about the gay scene when we first came to Melbourne, and I knew I was gay. John was sort of finding his way, but the way it worked was I had about 6 weeks off because I'd been working like a dog over in WA, so I decided to have a break, and then I finished up getting a job out in Paran, at a pub in Paran. Worked there as a barman for a year, and then finished up being headhunted by the bloke that I finished up working for 24 years. But we used to... when we lived in the boarding house, we were upstairs, and then the bigger rooms became available downstairs. So we moved downstairs, and that's where we met another couple of guys who were really into the gay scene, and they introduced us around. And then we used to go every Saturday night to the London Hotel and the Australia Hotel, and that was the place where you met everybody and you picked up and you had a great time.
So when you say you met everybody, who's everybody?
Well, all the local people in the scene, you know. It's and that's, I can't remember them all now.
But you describe what the scene was like?
The scene was that you would meet at the Australia Bar downstairs at the Australia if you were just the ordinary folk. If you were a bit upper class, you went upstairs to the cocktail bar.
And how did that division take place? What divided the downstairs from the upstairs?
I just think that you knew where you wanted to be.
Right, so it wasn't money. It wasn't money, but it was status.
The people that had the money were sort of up in the upstairs bar, and the sailors and all the rest of the people used to drink downstairs in the bullshit bar.
I'd rather stay.
Yeah, and then we'd walk. If you couldn't pick up for a party there, it was always looking for somewhere to go on a Saturday night. And if you didn't get a party there, you would walk around the corner to the London Hotel, which is in Elizabeth Street. And you'd go around there and you'd stay around there. And remember, the pubs close at 6 o'clock.
Right. Sleepy old Melbourne.
Yeah, sleepy old Melbourne. Yeah, beauty. So you close at 6 o'clock. And then you would, somebody would have a party, and then you'd go and buy two bottles of beer, and then you'd go and have something to eat, and then you'd go into the party with your two bottles of beer. And you always had to take at least two bottles to go to get into the party.
Mm. I love it.
Yeah. But that's the way we did, because there were no discos. There were none of those sort of places.
It sounds like a very free and easy lifestyle, but we're talking about the 50s, right?
We're talking 50s, 60s now. Yeah, early 60s.
This is prior to decriminalisation.
Oh, yeah.
You're all boarding together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you find any struggles with this?
No, not really. I think it was... We sort of knew, you know. I can remember coming up Flinders Street on the back of a ute. There's a whole crowd of screaming queens, drunken queens, in the back of a ute, stuck at the corner of outside a Young and Jackson's, shrieking their heads off, and the police just looked at us and laughed and waved.
Okay, so the police, you never had...
Well, never had any trouble with the police, no. Right. Well, we weren't doing anything in that what would be considered in those days to be... criminal, because we weren't having sex or anything. Right. We were just sitting in the back of the ute screaming our heads off.
So what about more broadly amongst your cohort?
Oh, yeah, there was a few people that you would always read the Truth newspaper, because the Truth newspaper always picked up the ones that had been in the courts for soliciting and unnatural perversions and all the rest of the things that they used to call it. And you think, oh, yeah, poor them, you know.
But there's some significant sentences.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so, there was a few, yeah. See, Noel Tovey, the actor, he talks about being picked up and put into prison. But he was part Aboriginal.
Right.
Yeah, and I met Noel many, many years ago when he was working in the theatre. Mm.
And if somebody was put into prison, are you aware of how they were treated in prison?
No, not at all. No, that really, I've never broken the law. I broke the law by being gay, of course. But fortunately, I've always stayed within the rights of the law, you know, without being caught.
So was it spoken that you should be careful of your behaviour when you're at these parties? You've got your two bottles of beer. Everyone's having a great time.
Oh yeah.
You just knew to sort of keep some behaviour under wraps.
Oh, not at the party. That was what it was. It was like modern discos. And you had dinner parties, and you'd have people around for dinner. We had a big party flat, actually. When we moved, John and I moved from St Kilda Road to Hotham Street in East Melbourne. And we had a party flat, and there was a party there every Saturday night, I can assure you. It was the party place to be. We used to have 50 or 60 people there every Saturday night.
And how did the word get out? Was it just through...
Just in, go to the pub, say, oh, there's a party on at home, come on, you know.
So pre-Facebook, the message still...
Oh, yes, as I keep saying, I told everybody that being gay, if you're gay, lesbian, bisexual or whatever it is, you're in a group that's bigger than Rotary.
So I'm guessing that gaydar was quite effective in those days.
Oh, you had a great gaydar. you knew who was gay and who wasn't. You could walk down the street and you'd know who was looking at you. Look, young people these days, they have it a lot freer than what we did, but they're not having any more fun than what we did, if you can understand that, you know, because we had the fun the way we made it, and we had to make our own fun. We didn't have to go to a disco and have loud music and dancing and all that sort of thing to have any fun. We had our own private fun. I think it was probably a lot nicer.
Did you have any stories of perhaps elders during this time of what their experience was previous to you coming to Melbourne?
Well, you never heard much of them. The elders were not there. They sort of kept to themselves. So you actually had sort of groups,
right?
Where you would have your group would be there and their group would be there, and sometimes you crossed over, but it was never. Sometimes the groups never met, but you knew who they were. We didn't have very many older people in our group. Because by the time you've got to, in the 60s, by the time I was 60, it was 66, I would have been 30.
And what about women, Gordon?
Well, there were women's, we never sort of had much to do with the women. There was always a divide between gay men and lesbians. And a lot of gay men didn't like lesbians. Mm. But I've always got on very well with women for some reason. I don't know what it is.
And it's your charm, Gordon.
I don't care. You know, if they're part of the community, they're part of the community as far as I'm concerned. But I've seen this go on, and I've seen some people say some terrible things about women, you know.
So what do you think prompted that?
I don't know. I don't know what it was. Probably historical, yeah. It was never against the law to be lesbian. This is the point. You see, it was never a law, and nobody worried about the women very much, you see.
Was that because they thought you couldn't prove it, or that women wouldn't be?
Well, look, I'm not sure, Jess. I'm not sure how that worked.
Right.
But for men, it was against the law to have sex with another man.
Yeah.
But that wasn't in the statute book for women.
Mm. Strange.
Yeah. Somebody once said about... I think that was never put in the statute book because Queen Victoria didn't think that women would do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some story like that goes into why it was never in the statute book for women.
Right.
But the women were around, of course, and women have always been the leaders. It doesn't matter what community you're in, women are the leaders. You take the Aboriginal community and you take other communities, women lead. And it's and the men... with the hunter-gatherers, they'd go out and fight and all the rest. The men love a fight. I couldn't care less. But the women are the ones that have to keep everything together. And this is why I think we should always have a woman prime minister, quite frankly.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
Because they think of things a different way.
You're on Our Voice, and we are joined in the studio today with Gordon and Jess.
So in Melbourne, just to paint the picture for me, was there an area other than the St Kilda Road boarding house, which I personally would like to have lived in, even though I am a woman and I would have had...
Oh, you would have been right. There were a lot of women there.
Was there sort of separate areas where the gay community tended to congregate other than in the city?
Oh, well, you could go to the South Yarra. There was the Maisie's Hotel, which is Her Majesty's Hotel in South Yarra. That was another place that was out of the city. There weren't too many hotels. It was easy to get into the city in those days. You know, it wasn't so bad. And because the pubs shut at 6 o'clock, you didn't have time to travel out to the suburbs or anywhere. You just went to the city and, you know. And most of the gay community was around the South Yarra area, South Yarra, Paran and Windsor and around that. They lived closer into the city.
And when you were travelling with a group of homosexual men, were you ever challenged by any...
Nope.
Anyone? No.
No. No, it was fine. People sort of think about it, but we had a very free society in those days. Mm. But as long as you didn't sort of go beyond the pale,
yeah.
If you went there, well, you could expect something. But no, it was fine. I've been abused, and but doesn't worry me. As I said before, pick on me, I don't care.
So you're on Our Voice with Caroline and Jess, and we have Gordon Wilson in the studio. And I would like to go back to Melbourne in the 50s.
You are listening to Our Voice with Caroline Vogels and Jess Moorhee on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Our Voice on Joy 94.9 with Caroline and Jess, and we have Gordon Wilson in the studio with us today.
And Gordon, you were talking about John, that you spent 17 years with him.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously had a great time partying and seeing lots of Melbourne and expressing your homosexuality.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about John and your relationship and...
Well, John worked in a electrical store for company. They sold electricals. They were up here on the corner of Lonsdale and Lonsdale and Swanston Street. There's a pub on the corner, and they had the building next door, and that's where he worked. And I worked in a pub in Paran. And it came to pass that he couldn't get anywhere in the business without him going interstate. And so they asked him if he would become the manager of their company in Adelaide. And the only way he could advance was to take that position. And so he was, I know Mum and Dad were staying with us because Mum and Dad loved him. They just thought he was a gorgeous guy. And he's just turned 75. It's his birthday 3 days ago, 4 days ago, 6th of June. And Mum and Dad were in bed, and John came to me, and he was crying. And I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I'm going to have to leave you." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well," and he explained the situation. And I said, and I thought, I can't say don't go, because that's not fair to him. And I knew that I couldn't go with him. So I said, "Look, it's going to be your decision. It's got to be what you want to do. But you've got to realize that if you don't go, you won't get anywhere in the business." And you had to be, I had to be practical about the whole damn thing, you know. And so he said, "Okay, fine."
So why did you feel that you couldn't go?
Well, I had a job. I had my job working here, and I didn't want to leave it. And I don't like Adelaide, which is one of the main things. I just don't like hot weather. That's why I live in Melbourne. That's why I came from Perth. I don't like hot weather. And so, but I thought, okay, well, I don't know whether the relationship was sort of petering out or what, but he just had to do that, you know. So, yeah. So.
Did you stay in communication?
Oh, yeah. I sent him an email for his birthday, and he sent one back saying...
But you didn't really sort of have weekend liaisons?
No. It was just one of those things. I worked on weekends. I couldn't get away, and that was fine. But he did very well. He finished up becoming the manager for the whole of South Australia and the Northern Territory, and he did pretty well for himself, so... Yeah, so we still keep in contact every now and again. We send one another an email, but yeah, he's still a nice guy.
So how did you cope with being single in the 70s?
Well, the worst part about it was taking him to the airport to fly away, you know, and I just walked away. People were looking at me at the airport. I must have had a shocked look on my face or something rather. But it was, yeah, it was the end of an era. It was the end of a, you know, that was it. Mm. Yeah, so couldn't do any more about it.
So did you partake in the party scene as a single man, or did you...
Yeah, well, from then on, I started working basically two full-time jobs. When he left, I decided I'd work, and because I owed my father some money, because he'd lent me some money to buy a flat, my first flat. And so I was fortunate enough to get a job at the John Curtin Hotel up the road through a friend of mine, because her husband owned the... thing. He was a big bookmaker. He owned it. And I finished up working up there for every night of the week for, I don't know how many years. Mm. Yeah. But I spent the next basically 22 years working two full-time jobs.
Wow.
So it sounds like you have got a long history of being a very busy man, Gordon.
Yeah, well, it's part of the family ethos, I think. You keep yourself busy.
And you're quite involved with quite a few organisations to this day. And so within the Victorian AIDS Council, you served a special role as the coordinator for the Momentum and Relationship Groups.
Yes, that's one of the things I did. When I first joined the AIDS Council, I was part of the Southern Supports region where I lived. And we used to look after people with HIV and people that were dying. I was a care team coordinator. I was a care team leader, and that meant visiting people, being with them all the time. And I had my own, you had your own client as well, looking after him. And started that in June 93, I think it was. And I'm still with the AIDS Council, and it's great.
How did you deal with the emotion of working so heavily?
I did. When I was with my first client for over 5 years, and when he went, I got sort of down, you know, and I didn't think it would affect me that much. And then the next thing I was working on, at the same time I was a care team coordinator, and another two people died, and I just went in a heap, you know. But that's one thing about the VAC, they did look after us. They had a counsellor, and I went and chatted with a counsellor for about 12 months. Mm. And it was fine after that. Yeah, she was great. Bev was a lovely woman. Mm. And used to have a great time talking to her once a month. Yeah, and so that brought me right over it. And I'm still there.
So you were involved in the Quilt Project. Tell us a little bit about...
Well, the Quilt Project, of course, started in America, and then somebody in Australia decided they would make a quilt. And so they started the Quilt Project, where everybody that died... or passed away, I should say, I suppose, the family and friends would gather, and they would make a quilt, a quilt which was 3 feet by 2 feet, I think it was, and then they would be put together as a block, what they call a block, and by the time the quilt was finally, the last time we showed it, I think there was 125 blocks with about 8 quilts on each block.
And what type of things did the family and friends...
Oh, they could do anything. They would sort of say about the life of the person that had gone. You know, there's one bloke, I can always remember this quilt because it's so damned heavy. He was into leather, and there was a leather jacket and a leather pair of boots, and that was to unroll that one. It's in the middle of a block, and that block was very, very heavy to lift up. Yeah.
And what about other?
People have rainbows on, and they'd have poetry, and they'd have photos and everything. And the only time you can get to see the quilt, the part of the Melbourne quilt that we have in Melbourne, is on World AIDS Day at the Positive Living Centre, and that we always put up quite a few around the bookshelves and everything.
And what's the response when people come into a hall and just see this magnificent tapestry of people's lives that have passed away? What's the response from people?
They're usually very quiet, actually, and they realise that these are people that have passed away through this dreadful disease. There's not so many people passing away so much these days, you know, and we don't get a lot of quilts being presented anymore. You know, we get the odd one, but you've got to wait until you get 8 of them to put them on a block, and so it's you just got to wait around. But it's become not a thing now. I think that the age of the quilt has gone. The last time we had the full lot was up at the exhibition building up in Nicholson Street there, and that was quite amazing to put that out and take it out, then fold it up, pack it away, and send it all back to Sydney. Then there's another big story about the way the Sydney people carried on with the quilt, I can tell you too.
Would you like to, or would you prefer
Well, it's all right, but the quilt used to be controlled by the Australian Quilt AIDS Memorial Quilt Association. They went broke, so they passed everything to the Sydney AIDS Memorial Quilt thing. They went broke, so they decided to give everything to the Powerhouse Museum. Now, Melbourne Quilt is very, very financial, and we said, no, we want every one of the Melbourne quilts back here in Melbourne. And we fought them, and we had to get solicitors onto it. It cost us a lot of money to get them, but we got every one of the Melbourne quilts back from Sydney, because they were going to put it on the web and tell everybody about everything. But there's a whole lot of confidentiality connected with the quilt and everything, you know. And we informed the Powerhouse Museum that they couldn't do that. And but we finally got them all back, and so we've got the Melbourne quilts here, which is what we feel that they have to be here, and not stuck in a museum where nobody can see them.
Of course, what a powerful tribute to...
It is a powerful tribute to the people that died, and some of the people that are on there, some of the talented people that went, you know, and ordinary people as well, you know, and we lost a few people.
I don't know too much about this next organisation I'd like to mention, Vintage Men. I've seen them in Pride March. They always look like they're having a jolly good time.
Yeah, well, Vintage Men have been going for, 20 years, I think it is. 20 years this year. Next March, I think, is 20, or it could be 21. I'm never quite sure of years. Years have no impact on me anymore. And I joined it about 10 years ago after I retired, because I just felt I didn't have time. I was still doing AIDS work, and I was still doing other things, and still, so I thought, okay, when I retire, I'll join Vintage Men. So I joined Vintage Men and was with them for a couple of years, and then I became on the board and the executive, and I'm now the treasurer of Vintage Men. And they meet once a week on a Monday night now, every Monday night at the Betty Day Centre in St Kilda. And we are a group of gay men or bisexual men, and our thing is that you don't have to be vintage type. It's for gay men and older gay men and their admirers. This is the way we call it.
Okay, so is there an actual age to make you qualify to be vintage?
No.
It's just your style,
you know. yeah.
I know your party.
I know men that are younger than me that are older than me.
Ah,
you see, this is the way. It's the way you think about life. And I've never been a, I've never been an old person. I hate being old. I'm
age
young.
Is just a number, isn't it?
It is just a number. That's what I said before. The years don't mean anything.
Great lead-in to our next song.
Right.
What a Wonderful World.
What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. Yeah. And this is what I think. We live in a wonderful world. We have our ups and downs. We have our trials and tribulations, but it's still a wonderful world. And it's better than the other place where we don't know what goes on. So I love this song. I think Louis Armstrong is terrific.
Our Voice, preserving the stories of our community elders. Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Our Voice on Joy 94.9 with Jess and Caroline. We have Gordon Wilson in the studio with us today. Now, Gordon, we asked you to bring something along that holds some history for you. So could you describe what you've brought and what it means to you?
Well, it's nothing really that special. It's a hat. It's a Stetson hat that I wear to every Pride March. And over the years, I've collected all the AIDS Memorial Candlelight Vigil and Quilt badges. So they're all on one side. And then I've got AIDS badges from all around the world on top of it. And that's all around the hat. And every time I get one, I put it on there. And the hat is getting heavier and heavier and heavier. And it's always, people have seen me wearing it at Pride March, I'm sure, when I've walked with Vintage Men carrying their banner, and it's got all the rainbow ribbons just all floating out the back. Yeah,
it seems like a tribute itself to the years that you've put in to support such an important cause.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And I just wear it, and it's been photographed. There's photographs of it have gone around the world, I can assure you, because everybody comes up and says, stand there and smile sweetly.
During the past hour, we have heard some beautiful, quite romantic stories about your life. We've last talked about John and your 17-year relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about your love life these days?
Well, I do have a partner now, yes. He's Chinese, and I met him when Vintage Men went to Echuca. We used to go up to Echuca for a weekend, and we'd all sort of go up there and stay at a place that was run by a gay guy. And he came along with the chap that he sort of stays with and looks after. He's a man in his late 80s now. And when I walked in, I saw this Chinese chap standing there. I thought, oh, Chinese gentleman, wonder who he is, wonder where he belongs, you know, which you do when you're sort of see new people that you've never met before. And I just went in and unpacked and everything, and I was sitting around there, and the next thing they introduced me, and they said, oh, this is George. And I said, hi, you know, chatter, and that was all I thought about it, you know, because I thought, oh, well, he's with the other chap, you know. So I've never been one to sort of break up partnerships or people. I don't believe in that. And sort of went along with everything. We went on the Murray River cruises and all the rest of it, up and down the Murray, and went to played the pokies and all the rest of it. And anyhow, when we were going on the Sunday morning, he just grabbed hold of me and planted this great big kiss on me. And I thought, oh, hello, what's going on here? And he said, I'll be in contact. And I said, okay. So about 3 weeks later, the phone call, oh, this is George. Sorry I missed you. I'll get back to you later. I dropped the phone and thought, who the bloody hell's George? I just didn't twig for one instant who it was.
Because you often have men just coming up and planting big kisses.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They do it all the time.
Of course. It's hard to keep track of the names.
Yeah, exactly, Jess. Actually, I get more kisses from women these days.
That can't be a bad thing either,
Jess. No, that can't be a bad thing either, yeah. And so it took me days to work out who it was. And suddenly I thought, oh, yeah, I know who it is. It's that guy I met up in Echuca. So he rang me up, and I said, okay, well, we can meet. And we had a cup of coffee, and things progressed from there. And we've been together now for about 7 years. We don't live together, which is because of the other elderly gentleman who he looks after. Rather, there's nothing sexual between. He's basically like a part-time carer for him, you know.
And how did George come into being into Vintage Men?
Well, he came as a friend of people that were in Vintage Men, and they knew all about it, and they got one of the rooms in the actual guest house part. We were in the it's a YHA dormitory for people that go picking grapes and those sort of things. But we go in there we used to go in the off season, so we would be in the dormitory sort of thing, you know, five or six to the room or whatever it was, and he was in the other part of the house. So But that's how he was there, and it was just one of those things.
But he was a Melbourne...
Melbourne. He'd come up from Melbourne. Yeah, he lives in Waverley.
And was he still in touch with his family?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. He goes back to Shanghai, and yeah.
So they've accepted him and his life? And
well, I don't know whether they've accepted him. I don't know whether he's out to his parents. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It doesn't worry me anyhow. He's out to me, so that's the main thing.
And do you have any involvement with his family?
No. I've met. We're planning. I said to him next time he goes back to Shanghai, I'm coming with him.
Oh, fantastic!
Because I've always had a fascination for China.
Yeah.
Ever since I was a kid, just always had a fascination for the place.
And does George have any involvement with your family?
No. He hasn't met there because there's been no opportunity for them to meet or anything. You know, I've got a lesbian sister-in-law. My sister's husband. His sister is a gay woman, and she was with her partner for 42 years, and Lizzie's the only one that knows about George.
Right.
Yeah. I told Lizzie, I said, and she's always worried about me because I'm by myself.
Right.
She's always had this thing, so one day I just said, look, I'm not by myself, actually, I do have George, but I'm just keeping it quiet until things change a little bit. Yeah.
What was the reason for keeping the relationship with George quiet when you were so out in all other areas of your life since 14?
Well, I'm out with... George is out there, but just not with the family because I don't see much of my family because we all lead busy bloody lives, my sister's retired there. She and her husband are on their way around Australia, one grey nomads, So I don't see them very often. My brother's... lives in Glen Huntly, and I see him occasionally. He never rings anybody. You've got to ring him to sort of have a chat. So, yeah.
So you sound like you've been very blessed with having a great sense of support and being involved in the community.
Oh, yeah.
With George being involved, I guess, in aged care with the elderly gentleman that he looks after.
Yep.
Is there a lot of support for, as you're getting older in the community, in terms of organisations?
Well, they've just suddenly started to realise that we need support for older gays and lesbians when they go into perhaps nursing home situations.
Yes.
And also have been doing a great thing with it.
So, sorry, when you say they, who's they?
I'm talking about there's Archers, the community health and sexual, they're doing a whole thing with it. The lady's name's gone right out of my head.
Not Catherine Barrett.
Catherine Barrett. She's the one that's sort of organising it. The Also Foundation ran a coffee lounge thing like Val's Cafe where they would get people that were in the aged care industry to come in and learn a bit about what it was like to look after gay and lesbian people. That was all started by a thing that Matrix and Vintage Men were involved with where they had a whole thing about what was happening in the nursing home situation for older gays and lesbians.
So the Matrix Guild is a group of women that have come together to promote lifestyles for elderly lesbians
so that they
can have a better life.
Yeah, that's right. They're the sort of like the... We're set two organisations together. There's Vintage Men and Matrix Women. Yeah.
Do you find that you're at a stage in your life where you're still living such a full and active life?
Oh, yeah.
How are your friends that you've sort of come through the years with, are they still around? Are they as much involved in the community as yourself?
Well, I don't know. I was never in the drinking crowd. I was never one to go and stand in pubs for hours and hours and hours. Used to do it 5 to 6 in the old days, but now I don't bother with it at all. Occasionally, somebody will turn up from way back when, but most of us have gone on, and a lot of them probably passed away by now, I think. Yeah, but I've never been one to sort of be worried about age. I prefer talking to younger people. They keep you young.
Well, on that note, what advice could you give to people who have either recently come out or maybe are struggling with the way that our world is today? Having come through so much yourself, what would you say to them?
I would say they've got to be themselves. They can't and don't stand up for – don't put up with bullying. Answer back, because that's the only way you'll get respect, because it's the way, if you answer back to these people, you'll get respect. You may get hit even, but don't let them do it to you. Don't lose your own self-respect. And that's the main thing, I think, is your own self-respect and the way you treat yourself. And that's the way to go. And just remember that you're not the only one out there like that.
And Gordon, you're involved in so many organisations. Mm. It's obviously for a reason. What has this done for you?
My father and mother were volunteers right up until basically they couldn't walk anymore, basically. You know, it comes from that. And I enjoy helping people. I think people are wonderful. I'm a bit of a Pollyanna. I really am. I don't see bad in people. Because it's just one of those things. I try not to see the bad in people, and mostly people are okay, you know. And I get more out of it than what I give, basically.
So I see you in the Joy Corridors. You're always mentoring younger people.
Mm.
And you're currently mentoring a gentleman named Tristan.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, Tristan's a guy, I think he's about 30, around about that age. He's just had a birthday as well. I was asked at the show, get Tristan to know how to use the panel, how to put a program together, because they want the people with disability. Now, Tristan has a slight mental disability, which makes him a bit slower than most people, but that's fine. He and I get on like a house on fire. And I don't know whether I'm slow. Probably am. But I've been showing him how to use the panel and the big panel here with all the buttons and the things, and how to play the CDs on time, how to back announce, how to forward announce, how to keep the program moving. And we've been training, doing that for quite a number of months now. And it's coming together. It's coming together. And I put him to wear first time on the Wednesday with our radiothon. And he was absolutely beside himself. He was so excited to be on, but when he got on got the other side of the thing, he clammed up, and I was trying to get him to say things, you know. I was trying to give him leading questions so he would talk, you know, but he got off and he said, "Oh, I was so bloody nervous."
But it must be a fantastic feeling for you to see Tristan grow.
I think it's lovely. I just think it's terrific, you know, and I just like doing it for him, you know. And it's if they want me to help anybody else in that situation, I would do it too. It's just me.
If there is one person whose advice or support has really resonated with you throughout the years, who would that be, and what was the advice?
That's a quick one, a hard one. Jess, I don't know. I've not sort of taken that much advice from people, because I've always sort of felt that I knew that what I was doing was right. Mm. I don't do heroes very much, but I do have one hero. And that's the Honourable Justice Michael Kirby. I just think he is just such a wonderful, wonderful man. And what he's done to advance the cause of our community is just amazing, with his quiet application to doing his job and doing it properly. And that's what I've always tried to do my job, do it properly.
I think that means so much. If somebody doesn't have many heroes, and you speak so highly of
I've met him. Yeah. I met him one World AIDS Day. I think lovely man.
We're going to interview him one day, aren't we, Jess?
He's on the list.
Yeah.
Good on you.
This is Our Voice on Joy 94.9.
Preserving the stories of our community elders. Joy 94.9.
You're on Our Voice with Jess, Caroline, and our special guest today is Gordon Wilson.
To wrap up, Gordon, we have some quick-fire questions for you.
These rapid-fire answers, okay.
Exactly. But if you can just sort of think, the first thing that pops into your head, there's no wrong answers.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what we have at the end of it.
All right.
So our first question is, who is your favourite GLBTI icon?
Well, I've just said Justice Michael Kirby.
It's a given. And if you could invite three people to dinner, obviously one would be Justice Michael.
Yes.
But who else would you like to invite for dinner, whether they be living or dead?
John Barrowman, the gay singer from London. I think he's great, a great entertainer. And somebody else, probably Kay Sara.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, Darren Pope. Yeah, I'd get Darren. He's always good for a chat. Mm. Yeah.
It would be an entertaining dinner party.
Would be a very entertaining dinner party.
If you could be anywhere in the world, where would you be right now, and why?
Well, I've always loved living in Melbourne. I choose Melbourne as the best place to live in the world. But if I didn't live in Melbourne, it'd be Vancouver.
Well, we knew it wasn't going to be Adelaide.
You're right there.
If you could go back in time to any decade, which would it be?
This has made me think now. Where would I like to be? It'd be all right if you were back in the 18th century if you had money. It'd be no good living there if you had no money, if you were just one of the lower classes. I wouldn't mind have been in Melbourne in the early days, in the very, say, at the beginning when Melbourne was founded. I think that would have been quite interesting to see how this city had been able to grow, because it's one of the great cities of the world as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Melbourne. Mm.
You've contributed many years here at Joy. If you could use one word to describe your time at Joy, what would it be?
Happy.
Cats or dogs, Gordon?
Cats.
Sunrise or sunset?
Both.
Is there any job?
Actually, sorry, sunrise. I'm an early morning person. I love early mornings. Get up there and you get out the back and you can listen to the birds calling and you see the sun come up and the colours of the sky. It's just because being an artist, you just look at the colours and it's just beautiful.
Is there any job you would like to attempt for a day?
Any job I'd like to attempt for a day? No, not really. I think I've done quite a lot of jobs, but no, I just think just getting up in the morning is a good job.
What's your favourite hobby?
Art, painting. Yeah, I paint.
And what's your favourite movie?
I saw it many years ago, a black and white movie called Separate Tables by Terence Rattigan. It was about a man that who was different and he was hounded because he had approached, there's a sexual connotation in it about I'm not sure whether he approached a young man in the movie or whether he approached a young woman who was underage, and that had reverberations in the boarding house he lived in England. And it's written by Terence Rattigan, and it's an absolutely, if you can ever get hold of that movie, you watch it. It's a fabulous movie.
You've been on Our Voice. You've been listening to Jess Caroline interviewing Gordon Wilson. Thank you, Gordon.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
You have been listening to Our Voice on Joy 94.9. For more information, head to joy.org.au to connect with Our Voice online.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.